You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a researcher who's found a genetic link for severe nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a chilly outing in Milwaukee that took place more than a century ago.
People do a lot to make the best of Wisconsin's brutal winters. Some strap on snowshoes or hit the sledding hills. The extremists participate in polar plunges. As Milwaukee historian and author John Gerda reminds us, the winter thrill seekers have been thriving in the area for a long time.
Were our ancestors really hardier than we are? Were they better equipped to weather Wisconsin's winters? One story says they were. On New Year's Day in 1895, 10 young men took the Milwaukee River from North Avenue all the way to Thiensville, a distance of 18 miles on ice skates. One of them, Joseph Bell, left a chronicle of the adventure and its warm reading on a cold winter's day. Wearing knickerbockers, thick sweaters, and strap-on skates, the group left Milwaukee at 10 in the morning. Many skaters were upon the ice for the first few miles north, wrote Bell, but we had only to climb over the first weir of frozen waterfalls where the dull roar of the under-cataract sounded solemn and uncanny to leave behind all these ephemeral merrymakers and the last view of the city. That cataract would have been in today's Estabrook Park. The real fun started once they had the river to themselves. But the skating, Bell enthused, such skating as it was, such ice and such a winter's day, as one might wait an entire season for to see. Not a stirring of the air, save that we made ourselves as we rushed along the smooth black surface. The skaters were on uncharted ice with plenty of hazards ahead. Their leader plunged into waist-deep water at the first flour mill, and Bell himself belly-flopped through what he called a 2-inch layer of slush water spread over a surface of sunken ice. But there were pleasant surprises as well. In shallow parts of the midstream, he recalled, we could see the fishes through ice clear as window glass. The Milwaukeeans reached Thiensville in 3 hours and 40 minutes, traveling at an average speed of 5 miles an hour. The pot of gold at the end of their rainbow was a prearranged royal good dinner of turkey and goose at Memler's Inn, a German place on the river. The skaters, Bell reported, were famished. I am afraid the smiling folk who gazed at us through the sliding panel from the kitchen must have wondered if we had ever had a square meal in our lives. In half an hour, the table looked as if a typhoon had struck it amidships. After a full meal and a few drinks, most of the travelers took the train back to the city. Not Joseph Bell and two of his hardier companions. Even though night was falling, they decided to skate home by moonlight. And that, according to Bell, was the best part of the journey. On we sped at ever-increasing pace until we had reached the limit for safety, and only tempering our speed when crackling surface ice and an opaque appearance of the river ahead warned us of rapids underneath and ticklish skating above. Despite their best efforts to read the river, the skaters experienced several somersaults, wrote Bell, and one of them plunged into a waterhole 2 feet deep. The trio reached the North Avenue Bridge at the stroke of 8, with their clothing frozen hard and clanking like steel armor. Bell still faced a long streetcar ride home to the west side, but he had no regrets. Truly, it was entrancing, that return trip, and romantically beautiful. By far the most conspicuous recollection that remains to me of the entire outing. You don't have to skate to Thiensville and back, but Joseph Bell's chronicle is a welcome reminder of winter's unique potential for fun. Bell and his buddies had the right idea. Unplug, they might tell their modern-day descendants. Turn off those tyrannical screens. Get outside and enjoy winter like genuine four-season Wisconsinites.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born author and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Central Time. Morning sickness is a fairly common condition during pregnancy, but a more severe condition is a risk coming up in about 2% of pregnancies. It's called hyperemesis gravidarum, or HG. Unlike normal morning sickness, hyperemesis is severe, debilitating and can last a lot longer than the first trimester of pregnancy. Untreated, it can lead to serious pregnancy complications, even death. New research has found a link between a variant in a gene for a hormone that causes nausea and vomiting, and maybe a roadmap to potential cures. We're talking about this kind of severe, debilitating nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you dealt with this hyperemesis gravidarum? Did your doctors dismiss you, or at first maybe? Were you able to receive help? How did that condition affect your pregnancy, your well-being? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Marlena Faso is a medical scientist behind the new research on hyperemesis gravidarum. She's a clinical assistant professor of population and public health sciences in the Center for Genetic Epidemiology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Marlena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Your research into the causes and potential cures for this condition, obviously of interest, but it was in part inspired, I understand, by your own personal experience with this condition. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I had very severe hyperemesis gravidarum, where it was so bad that I could not eat, drink, or move without violently vomiting. This went on for weeks, and eventually, my doctor put me on 7 different medications at once, but nothing allowed me to be able to eat. And so I was put on a feeding tube, but it was too late. And eventually, I lost the baby in the second trimester. I am a scientist. I was already focused on women's health research. So I decided to look into what was known about it after that, and decided to dedicate my life to figuring out what caused it, since there was really next to nothing known about it and a lot of incorrect myths that I knew had to be wrong.
Right. Before we get into your findings, it really struck me. This is about 2% of pregnancies, obviously a very serious condition. I would think it would be an easy sell to get research funding, to get your department heads to get on board with this. No, the people didn't seem to be eager to even pursue research on this. Can you talk about what you had to overcome and where you ultimately went to get some research findings?
Yeah, so there's very little research in conditions of women, conditions of pregnancy. I think it's mostly because of the thalidomide tragedy, where in the 1950s, people were given thalidomide to treat their nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. And unfortunately, the babies were born with limb deformities. And so that really put a stop to research into this condition. And in addition to that, it was this myth that people with HG, that something psychological was going on, that still happens to be taught today, that people don't really want their babies, and ridiculous theories like that that have been perpetuated and are still perpetuated to this day. So I hope this study puts an end to that. But yeah, so I tried to get the research going and to apply for grants, and my grants were not accepted. So I ended up, I was collecting patients all this time over 10 years, speaking to patients every Friday and getting their DNA samples to do a genetic study, but I couldn't get funding to do the genetic analysis. And so I then partnered with the personal genetics company, 23andMe, because they had a brilliant model where they were asking their customers to opt into research studies, and then they would ask them questions, and they already had their genetic data so that they could do the same type of analysis that I was trying to do. And they agreed, and they put in questions on hyperemesis in their survey, and it was turned out to be very fruitful. So that was the first study. It was published in 2017, where we were able to show a connection between the gene that codes for this pregnancy hormone and this appetite and nausea and vomiting hormone, GDF15. And then after that, I was able to get my patients that I was unable to get funding for before sequenced by the company Regeneron Genetics Center, and they sequenced my patients and my controls that did not have it. And then we found, again, that in that case, the only significant risk factor was a mutation in GDF15 and a rare variant, a common and a rare variant we identified, both happened to be in GDF15 in that study. So there's this strong link between that gene and that hormone, which we already know, knew at the time was involved in another disease called cachexia, which is a disease that even if you haven't heard of, you've seen, I'm sure, where patients die not from their cancer, but from their cachexia. They basically lose their appetite and have severe weight loss and muscle wasting. And in that disease, the cancers are producing a huge amount of the same hormone that the placenta also makes in pregnancy. So similar diseases, but one occurs during pregnancy and one occurs with cancer. So that's where we first found this link. And then for the recent paper that was just published in Nature, we figured out the mechanism.
Talk us through that mechanism now. You found this gene, it produces this hormone, a GDF, or it's responsible for production of GDF15, a mutation here. What then is going wrong?
Yeah, so it was actually really surprising. We expected that what was going wrong in these patients was that the gene was doing something to make the patient have too much of this hormone, because the hormone causes nausea and vomiting. But what we found in this paper actually was that those genetic variants that we had identified, two common and one rare one, all were associated with having lower levels rather than higher levels. So this was really confusing, and I was scratching my head trying to figure out what was going on here. How could something that predisposes you to nausea and vomiting and is a hormone that causes nausea and vomiting be present at lower levels in people with hyperemesis gravidarum and predispose them? And so I partnered with an endocrinologist, Stephen O'Reilly, who's the lead author on the paper, and he is an expert in hormones. And so he had the idea that maybe this hormone acts like other hormones in that it can be desensitized. And so he tested that in mice. This is my favorite part of the paper. And he showed that you could actually desensitize the mice to the hormone, which is a feature of other hormone pathways. So basically, you can, when you give mice a high dose of this hormone, which is similar to the dose that pregnant people get, it causes the mice to stop eat or lower their food intake and lose weight. But if you give them a smaller dose, a little dose of it prior to that, you can desensitize them. So those mice that were given the small dose prior to the high dose, they did not have any appetite loss or weight loss compared to the controls that were not given the priming dose. So then we looked at the reverse, which was looking in humans. We found that in humans there is a condition called thalassemia, and in that condition, patients have lifelong high levels of this hormone. The hormone doesn't only occur during pregnancy. It also is produced at high levels in states where your body is under physical stress. So when you have an infection or a disease, any kind of weakened state, it's sort of the body's way, we think, to signal that you're more likely to survive if you rest and recover rather than go out searching for food, which was probably very useful during our hunter-gathering stage for the survival of our species. But now when it, you know, driving to the market is not a very risky thing. We don't probably need this anymore, but it still exists. So
we'll pick up that thread in just a moment. We have to take a quick break. We're talking about a condition that causes severe nausea and vomiting during pregnancy with Marlena Faso from the University of Southern California, a lead researcher on a big finding on the causes of this fairly common condition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the causes of hyperemesis gravidarum, which causes potentially life-threatening nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Marlena Faso is with us, lead researcher on a big finding on this condition. She's with the University of Southern California. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in St. Paul. Lisa, hi.
Hi, Dr. Faso. I just wanted to thank you so much for doing this research. I actually had HG in my pregnancy 14 years ago, and I took part in your study, mailed my samples of saliva and other medical records from St. Paul and took part in one of your early studies. And I just want to thank you so much for everything you've been doing in this area.
Lisa, thanks so much for sharing that. Marlena, people like Lisa have been a big part of your research findings.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful to all the participants. I mean, some of these participants called me from their hospital beds to participate. So, you know, or they have small children or they're pregnant and ill. So I couldn't have done this without them. And I'm really grateful that they participated in the study and we finally got here.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Now, Marlena, I want to pick up. You mentioned, you know, we've got this finding, this gene that leads to people having this GDF15 hormone that's causing the nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Now, maybe treatment. You were talking about sort of pre-treating mice to avoid the worst impact. And you were talking about now there are some people who have a higher level of this hormone. What happens then when they get pregnant?
Yeah, so that's the fascinating thing is that those people have either no nausea and vomiting at all, or a few of them had very little levels of nausea and vomiting. So now we can see that it looks like we should be able to prime people with this condition when they want to get pregnant again by increasing their levels of GDF15 prior to pregnancy to decrease their sensitivity to the hormone when it rises rapidly during pregnancy. So hopefully we can test that. So that's one approach to prevent HG by increasing the levels prior to pregnancy. And then during pregnancy, we are looking at approaches to decrease the hormone or block it from binding the receptor during pregnancy to decrease the nausea and vomiting during pregnancy.
Now, I know this is still in early stages, but I'm wondering how this would work. We wouldn't necessarily know until someone's pregnant if they're going to have this. Are you thinking, well, maybe we have a thing where we do a genetic screening? Do you have this mutation? If so, then we try this GDF15. I know it's not exactly inoculation, but preparation?
Yeah, so we're looking into that, and we're not quite there yet because most of the risk variants were identified in people of white European descent. So I'm trying to get funding to look more broadly at the variants so that we can have a genetic screening test that works for everyone. But we also can test people that have had a prior pregnancy. So many people who have hyperemesis decide not to go through pregnancy again because it's such a horrible experience for them and decide to limit their family size. So those people, they contact the HERF Foundation all the time, the Hyperemesis Education and Research Foundation, asking if there's anything new out there to prevent them from having it again. So there's a high recurrence risk. And so those people would be the people that we would start the approach with. To see if we can sort out the details with them and get it working well. And then we can try to go into helping more people more broadly even before they've ever had an experience with HG.
And Marlena, in just our last minute or so, today, if somebody's diagnosed with this hyperemesis during pregnancy, do we have anything in our toolkit to help them out at least a little?
Yeah, so I mentioned the HERF Foundation, and I highly recommend people go to hyperemesis.org and check out. They have so many resources and tools for people to share, protocols that people can share with their provider. There are medications that can help, IV fluids. There is also, I always say people should take thiamine or vitamin B1 because there is a rare but dangerous side effect that can occur, or condition that can occur if you don't have enough vitamin B1. So that's another thing I recommend. But yeah, there's many resources on the website of the HERF Foundation. So that's the best place to go, I think, Marlena, and support as well.
Marlena, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Marlena Faiso, Clinical Assistant Professor of Population and Public Health Sciences in the Center for Genetic Epidemiology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. She talked to us about her research on hyperemesis gravidarum, a potentially severe condition a lot of people face during pregnancy, and her big research findings on that. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Wisconsin journalist shares her family's long story of dealing with mental illness. We'll meet the author of the new book, While You Were Out. And Rotary, Kiwanis, and other volunteer organizations have played a big role over the years in American civic life, but they've also faced challenges recruiting new members over the decades. We'll dig into the role of these civic organizations and their future. If you are or have been involved with one of those groups, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the Dean of Boston University's School of Public Health about how he believes leaders in his field need to rebuild public trust after the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For our next guest, the COVID-19 pandemic marked a turning point for the field of public health. On one hand, he says there's a lot to be thankful for in the public health world and that experts and officials accomplished a lot, often with limited resources. But on the other hand, he says the crisis exposed and increased some flaws in the world of public health. Among other things, he says public health experts lost the trust of many Americans, in part by letting the field become politicized and by rejecting viewpoints that didn't go along with the mainstream consensus. He says we're now in a place where the country's public health institutions and leaders need to take action to rebuild a lot of the trust with the public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did public health experts, leaders, officials get right and wrong, do you think, during the pandemic? What do you think, with hindsight now, about things like partial shutdowns, mask mandates, remote schooling that we went through here in Wisconsin? Did it go on too long? Not long enough? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Sandro Galea is dean and Robert A. Knox professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. Sandro, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
I think to avoid confusion out here, I want to talk about the word liberal. When we're talking about American politics, we use it as, you know, to the left, opposite of conservative, things like that. You're using it in a different sense and an older sense of the word. Talk about the meaning of liberal, especially in the public health context.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, exactly as you said, an older sense of the word liberal. By liberal, I mean Enlightenment era values, things that emerged from the Renaissance, really, which is a centering individual autonomy, centering the individual at the heart of decisions we make, making decisions based on reason, not theological concerns, and thinking about reasoned reform and building change slowly, keeping the individual at the heart of everything we do. In many respects, the notion of liberalism has more in common with and has echoes to today things like libertarianism. But it is fundamentally about saying an individual is autonomous and our role in society is to make sure that individuals live the best possible lives. That's what I mean by liberalism.
And one concern of many you raise in the book that you hope public health experts think about is you see a lack of concern about trade-offs on things like civil liberties when it comes to public health measures. I'm oversimplifying maybe, but to expand on that.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're oversimplifying. It's obviously a very complicated issue. But one of the challenges which I raise in the book, and by the way, I commend you on your introduction to the book because I think you summarize it very well, is that the lens of public health became very narrow, that we were focused only on one outcome and one outcome alone, which was to reduce the spread of COVID. Now, I'm careful in the book, and you also preface an introduction, to say this was a global pandemic, a global tragedy like none we have lived in 100 years. So there were reasons for us to be afraid. There were reasons for us to be cautious. But that fear led us to think only about one thing, which is COVID counts and consequences of COVID. And we forgot that societal decisions need to balance health, but also social function, educational function. All of that also, by the way, has implications for health in the long term. But it is a mistake to think that mitigating a virus today is the only thing that matters, because many other things matter in order for us to preserve, to go back to the notion of liberalism, individual autonomy, to create lives that individuals want to live in, have, find joy in, be able to actualize themselves, be able to have economic function, go to school and learn. All of those things are forces that we need to balance, and balance in the context of trade-offs as we think about right decisions for society. And public health pushed very hard and advocated very hard for a very narrow conception of that, one that focused only on the health dimension, forgetting these other dimensions that also should matter to us.
Where do you see the most damage from what you see as that lack of balance?
Well, I think in a number of ways. Pragmatically, for example, and you mentioned this also in your introduction, most experts now agree that kids have lost about 6 months of education. And by education, I mean both subject matter education, but also social and emotional development. That is an enormous consequence for society, because kids will carry that with them throughout their lives. Any of your listeners who have kids who were in school at the time, leaving aside the inconvenience and the difficulty of dealing with kids who are at school, you now recognize that there are behaviors that for their age, they're behind in because they had not had a chance to be socialized. So I think and perhaps on a smaller scale, there are these immediate consequences. Here I'm talking about kids. Obviously, it's a really important scale, but I call it smaller scale. Because at the larger scale, I think the consequence is a instinctive loss of trust in public health that people are showing. Now, I'm not just saying this impressionistically. Data, for example, from the Pew Trust Survey, which comes out about once a year, just came out about a month ago, shows there was about a 25-point drop in confidence in science and in health. That means that now it is a minority of people who trust that science and health are acting in the best interest of the public. And that is an enormous price to pay, because we want the public to trust that science and health is acting in the best interests of creating the kind of life we want. So I circle back in the book to saying that this loss of trust is a really profound consequence, that the downstream consequences years after COVID, if we cannot rectify this loss of trust, will be greater than the gains we made in a time of COVID by focusing so narrowly on the particular health outcome we were interested in.
Now, some might make the argument and have made the argument with, say, school closures. Kids aren't the only ones in schools. Staff might have been put at risk. We might have lost the teachers who are teaching those kids, disrupting education in a different way. People might weigh the balance you just presented in different ways, I guess.
Absolutely. And in fact, part of the book's core argument is that I want to encourage us weighing those arguments. I want to encourage people in good faith to have the arguments that balance what's the risk of transmission in schools. We knew all along that the risk of transmission for children is actually quite low, that the consequences for children were low. As a result, the risk of transmission to teachers was quite low. But was it low enough for us to keep schools closed? Maybe, maybe not. And in many ways, in the book, I'm careful to illustrate these challenges without being dispositive about what the right thing for us to do was. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to say that in future, and the book is careful to be forward-looking, not backward-looking. Mm-hmm. I really don't come down one way or another on what we should have done on schools. And I do that intentionally because my goal is not to point fingers. This was a difficult time. A lot of good people tried to do the best possible under very difficult circumstances. What I'm trying to do is to say, if and when this happens again, we should create the space for that conversation, honestly articulating the benefits and the harms, the pros and the cons, so that we can come to the best place, best solution for society, weighing those harms and benefits.
Talking to Sandro Galea from the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can join in with your thoughts on what you've heard from the guests or questions for him at 800-642-1234. Maybe public health lessons you hope we learn from the COVID era. Join in at 800-642-1234. Another concern you raise, Sandro, is that the public health world became identified and partly of its own doing with one side of our political divide in the country. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you see driving that and the consequences.
Yes, we need to recognize that public health is always political. When something that public health is interested in and has to engage with changing social structures, that is political. However, being political means engaging in the public conversation about decisions we make as a society. It does not mean being identified with one party. Being political is different than being partisan. And one of the challenges public health faced during COVID was that it became a blue endeavor, where public health became identified with one particular party. Now, in the defense of public health, and I'm clear about this in the book, there was a president in the White House in 2020 who very explicitly was pushing back against a lot of well-established data, a lot of well-established fact about COVID. So public health found itself almost against its will in opposition. But be that as it may, the point I try to make is that the point of public health is to serve the health of the public, all the public. And that means that if public health is seen as serving only blue America, we are not doing our job. We're in fact doing only half our job. And it is on us to make the extra effort to make sure that everybody recognizes that public health is not blue or red. Public health is purple.
And I know I've read elsewhere you've hosted dinners with people from conservative think tanks who are skeptical about the concept of public health as a government responsibility. How do you try to reach out across that boundary to get them on board and just to make your case to them?
In exactly that way, I would like to encourage conversations. We invite to our school speakers who come from different sides of the political spectrum with intentionality. We try to open up our community and encourage our community to have an open mind to arguments and debates from multiple sides of the political spectrum. That does not mean that one cannot arrive at a place in one's mind that balances empiric evidence and moral imperatives and say this is the right path forward. But it does mean that we should always have space to listen to a plurality of perspectives for people who have different value sets, who see the world differently, who bring a different moral perspective to the questions that matter to public health.
We're talking about how to improve public health, learn lessons from the COVID era, and issues of public trust for our public health system. Sandro Galea stays with us, Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you have lessons that you hope we learn from the COVID era and how we tackle issues of public health, how we balance concerns about stopping the spread of a virus with impositions, serious ones potentially, on our daily lives? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sandro Galea, Dean and Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. He's hoping we can learn lessons, do better with public health, rebuild public trust in the system, and have the system deserve that trust at 800-642-1234. You could join in. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Hi, Chris.
Hello, good afternoon. So I guess my comment kind of slash question, if you will, I believe that I by and large agree with the guest, but I was wondering what your thoughts were on kind of the systematic approach to healthcare in this country, where our privatized approach seems to kind of incentivize a more profit-driven or politicized approach to healthcare. And only in more recent days here, post-pandemic, if you will, it seems that doctors have tried to kind of wrestle back some of that authority in kind of in more of a doctor-minded approach to medicine rather than a privatized one.
Chris, thanks for the call. Sandra, I think you were thinking about these issues long before we heard of COVID-19. Do you have some thoughts for Chris?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. The challenge that this country has is that we don't really have a healthcare system, right? What we have is a deeply fragmented system of multiple providers, many of them private providers. Even if it's a not-for-profit, they're still private providers that do what best serves their needs. And that does not create a system which incentivizes our values. And our values really are, we want to be healthy, right? Chris wants to be healthy. I want to be healthy. Rob, you want to be healthy.
Sure.
So there is a tension between what we want out of healthcare and our healthcare system and how we structure it. That is a real problem. Now, in the context of COVID, we saw, for example, that our outcomes, when people were admitted to hospital with COVID in this country, they did as well as they did in any other country. So within hospitals, our care level tends to be very high. But what we are terrible at is marshaling a system to keep us healthy to begin with. That is a real problem. To do that, we are going to need an alignment of our national values with creating the kind of world that generates health. That means a world where we all have opportunities to exercise, where we have clean water, where we have clean air, where we have ability to live in a way where we work without overworking. All of that is what ultimately generates health. And those are the conditions that were not there before COVID, making us sicker than we needed to be before COVID hit, so that when COVID happened, we were then sitting ducks for getting even sicker.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sandro, another concern you raise in the book is that the public health community, I'll call it broadly, was subject to a kind of groupthink where people kind of wanted to line up with what they all agreed with and was not as open as you hoped to people offering differing opinions, raising concerns. How did you see that evolving?
Yeah, I observed, and I think many others have observed and written about this rapidity towards orthodoxy. And that orthodoxy was, I think we felt we had to do it because of the time pressure. But in doing so, we shut off room for discussion and debate, which has eventually come back to haunt us. I opened the book with this illustration, Rob, where I talk about a bakery where I get pastries every weekend. And in the end of 2021, this is after vaccines, when everybody was vaccinated, when mask mandates were lifted, the bakery had a sign on its door which said, "We know that in this community, health authorities have said we don't need to wear masks, but we feel otherwise, we still want you to wear a mask." Now, the reason I use that example is I ask the reader, can you imagine a time before COVID when a bakery, which doesn't have its own body of medical advisors, would put up a sign on the door that says, "Medical experts say the following, but we disagree, you should do something different." Like, it's hard to imagine that ever happening before COVID, right? That, to me, speaks to the things that we did in a way we did them eroded public trust. And I argue that us coming to conclusions in a particular way without listening to dissenting voices was part of what contributed to this problem.
Talking to Sandro Galea about his new book, Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. Sandro, over the course of the last few years, I've talked to a lot of public health experts, mostly here in Wisconsin, and they faced a challenge. We were learning on the job, kind of, with COVID as we figured out what it was doing, how it spread, things like that. they had a public that wanted definitive messages in some ways, but also they knew that the best answer they gave this week might be different next week. What lessons do you draw from that when it comes to health communication the next time there's an uncertain public health crisis?
My central lesson about health communication, and I think health communication is one of the areas where we probably have most to learn, is that we need to communicate uncertainty and be honest about it. One of the ways in which we faltered is, and in part this was because of social media and the way social media works and how one communicates on social media, is that we made pronouncements that felt definitive. We had what I call false certitude. And then when the data changed, and we had to change our mind, as was appropriate, it felt to the public like, well, we don't know what we're talking about, and we were just wrong time and time again. One of the ways in which we need to get much better communicating is to say, this is what we think is best today based on the data we have available, but let's be clear, when the data change, and we expect them to change tomorrow or the day after, we are going to recommend something different, and to be very clear in our communication that way. And my contention in the book is that people, the public, we can handle uncertainty. We can handle experts saying, we don't know for certain that this is the answer, but this is what we think is best. And we faltered in trusting that people could handle uncertainty, feeling that we had to tell people, here are the facts. So that then when the facts changed, people rightly lost confidence in what we were saying.
One of your biggest worries, I think, if I'm reading you right, Sandro, is that we may face the temptation in this country, and public health leaders may face the temptation to give up on some of that liberal, the old school version of liberal tradition, and revert to something more authoritarian. The extreme example being China and its zero COVID policy, which I think most people in the United States think went way too far. How big a concern is that for you?
Well, I suppose when I have a conversation like this, Rob, I feel optimistic because I think the way to avoid that concern, the way to ward us away from that path is by having these conversations, by being honest about it, by saying, let us look forward. How can we do better? Let's create space for differing voices. As long as we can do that, I'm not so concerned. If we don't do that, then I am really worried. Yes, I do use the example of China, which I would argue was an effort that was not grounded in any science ever, and fundamentally a very authoritarian, deeply paternalistic approach that served more to advance political purposes in China than it did to advance public health, but it was done in the name of public health. And I call it chapter, not in the name of public health, specifically because of that. And I don't want public health, which is what I've given my adult professional life to make that mistake. I want us to make sure that we always are centering the individual, autonomy of the individual. We are driven by data, not by ideology, that we have the space to have multiple competing inputs so we can figure out the best possible path, recognizing that there may be more than one excellent path, and that we build a healthier world based on those foundations. And that is what the book tries to push for, and that is what conversations like this give me confidence that we can do.
I wonder, you know, when you read back about the influenza epidemic 100 years ago, or smallpox before we were even a country, these debates about public health measures versus our civil liberties, they've always been around. Is this something that public health is always going to be wrestling with?
I hope so, because I think there is no clear answer to any of these, and I think that's okay. I think the mistake is when we pretend there's a clear answer. The mistake is when we draw lines too quickly and where we say, no, the right answer is unequivocally the following, and without leaving space both for recognizing that your right answer and my right answer may feel different, and we should actually give space for that conversation. And B, the data may change tomorrow, and the right answer may change tomorrow.
Sandro, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sandro Galea, Dean and Robert A. Knox Professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. He joined us for a look at his new book called Within Reason, A Liberal Public Health for an Illiberal Time. You can follow these conversations all the time, anytime at WPR.org, or you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming of all of our networks and extensive archives. Plus, if you like a conversation you hear, it's pretty easy to share it with a friend via social media, email, or what have you. Again, check it all out at WPR.org or with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.